You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Dominion Voting Systems settled a defamation lawsuit against Fox News this week for nearly $800 million. We'll talk to an expert on media law about the case and what the settlement means for the future of Fox News and the media in general. Now, as the weather warms up in Wisconsin, we're looking forward to a steady parade of fruit, from rhubarb to berries to apples and a lot more. And on this edition of Food Friday, our guest says there's a lot we can do with fruit in the kitchen, from sweet and simple desserts to salads to savory entrees. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite dish to make and or eat that uses fruit? Salads, desserts, main courses, you name it. Or do you have a question about how to use some kind of fruit in your cooking? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Abra Behrens is a chef, former farmer, and writer based in Michigan. Her new book is called Pulp, A Practical Guide to Cooking with Fruit. Abra, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh my gosh, thanks so much for having me. I was saying earlier, I love public radio so much, so it's always a treat to get to talk to you all.
Fantastic. Well, it's good to have you back. Now, I love, you talk about the reaction from your friends when you were talking about writing this book, and a lot of them were like, it's fruit, you just eat it. Why do we need to cook with it? What was your reaction? What led you from that to actually writing the book?
Well, I mean, I've been thinking about the fruit cookbook for probably going on 10 years because someone who attended a farm dinner I was hosting a while back sort of noted that there was a lot of fruit in the savory courses. And it hadn't really occurred to me that that was out of the ordinary until that person said it. And so then as I was kind of researching the book and thinking about what people needed out of a fruit cookbook, yeah, it was like 50-50. My friend said, why would I need a cookbook? You just eat it. And then the other 50% said, oh, I never buy fruit because I don't know what to do with it. And so it seemed like it was kind of a happy medium that we could find. And that was the idea, was to really give people a lot of options, both for baking things, but then really all of these savory dishes as well.
One thing I love about this book is, you know, you're in Michigan, we're in Wisconsin, we have a similar fruit palette here. You're not telling us to go in the backyard and pick Meyer lemons off of our tree or anything like that. You are really a fan of the abundance of fruit in Michigan and the Midwest. Can you talk about that a little?
It's true. And Wisconsin grows a ton of fruit, not quite as much as Michigan. We're the second most agriculturally diverse state in the nation, but Wisconsin is close behind. And you guys have, you know, just as many cherries in a lot of ways and amazing apples and all of those things. So I really wanted to, in all of these books, Roughage, my first book, and Grist are all really featured on ingredients grown here in the Midwest because there's so many of them. And, you know, as much as I love eating pineapple, I don't really cook with it that often because we don't have it in the abundance that we have some of our other items. So I left that for somebody else to write about, but we're really focusing on the kind of primary 20-25 ingredients that are grown here in the upper northern Midwest.
And in those other books, and now in Pulp, it's not just a cookbook. You interview farmers, people with orchards, and other cooks in some cases. And you talk about, you know, all farming brings unique challenges. Growing fruit has some very unique ones in that, you know, if I plant cucumbers this spring, I can eat cucumbers later in the summer. Fruit is a multi-year endeavor. Could you talk about some of what you heard from the Michigan farmers you talked to?
Yeah, you know, everything that was written about before is pretty much an annual. So you plant the seed, grow it, harvest it, and eat it right then. And perennial crops really have this added layer of complexity with regard to their overhead. So on average, for a cherry tree to come to full capacity, it's about 7 years from when the tree is planted. And that, you know, that doesn't mean it's 7 years just sitting in a barn somewhere. There's still, you know, mowing and tending and pruning and all those things that need to happen. And apple trees can last, you know, hundreds of years. And so they're really big investments. So one of the things that I was wanting to convey to non-growers is just the nature of what it means to have that overhead and to really be managing that type of crop, both with regard to climate collapse and decisions that people are making for the next, you know, 30 years to 50 years, but also just in terms of the different scales and markets. You know, I spent a lot of time in the Traverse City area that grows a ton of cherries, and it occurred to me one day driving around around that I don't know how many of our visitors realize that those aren't going to a farmer's market. You know, most of those cherries are going into something like cherry pie filling or tart cherry concentrate or, you know, cherry barbecue sauce, things like that. And so there's several different markets that really affect how a farm runs. And I guess for me, I just believe that to really love food, you have to know a little bit about how it's grown or at least appreciate the work that goes into bringing it to market. So that's the idea behind the interviews.
And you are a fan of getting local produce when possible, not just, you know, in general or for its own sake. You really like being able to meet the farmers and experiencing the variety that that local farmer can provide. What have you gained from your contact with local farmers for on the fruit book and your other ones?
So many times I go to a market or, you know, somewhere, even to a grocery store. You know, the people that work in grocery stores are seeing this food day in and day out. And just by simply asking them what they're excited about right now, you have a better chance of getting turned on to something that is either tasting perfect or is new and exciting. And the entire ground cherry chapter in Pulp was really kind of inspired by the fact that I didn't know what a ground cherry was until I started working here at Grainer Farm. And it was the grower here that was like so excited about them and wanted me to taste them. And so tasting it was like, oh, there's this whole new ingredient that I get to work with and, you know, really kind of decide how I want to weave it into the dishes that we make.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Abra Behrens. Her new book is called Pulp, A Practical Guide to Cooking with Fruit. She focuses on fruit that we could see here in the Midwest. Not a lot of citrus here, but a lot of variety. She's in Michigan. We're in Wisconsin. Do you have favorites? Do you have a question for our guest about what to do with all the blank that maybe grows on a tree in your backyard, or you can get a lot of it at your local grocery or farmer's market? Join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Abra, you mentioned savory dishes. I think people might not always think of a lot of fruit ending up there. Before getting into some specific recipes, can you talk about the joy of using fruit in, you know, in our meals, our savory meals?
Well, I grew up in a household that was very much, you know, pork chops and applesauce, and maybe there's a salad on the side. My mom was an incredible cook, but that was definitely something that we had in our rotation. So maybe that's where it started. But the idea is that, you know, fruit has some natural acidity. It has sweetness to it, things like that. And so it's able to really cut through the richness of some of the richer meats like pork and lamb and duck, but also things like cheeses, any sort of like, there's a salad in the book that is cucumbers, melons, and chickpeas with a buttermilk dressing. So you've got that richness from the chickpeas and from the buttermilk, and the melon just really rounds it all out. So it lends lots of color, lots of a little bit of sweetness and some acidity that kind of balances out a dish.
You've shared a couple recipes with us. We've got them up at WPR.org/Food Friday. Ginger poached apricots over salmon. This one sounds really good. I like salmon. I don't think I would have thought of putting apricots on it. What are they doing there?
Well, I really love using the lake fish. And so this is also really good with lake trout or the salmon that we produce here in the Midwest. And the salmon is very simply steamed with some choy. And then the apricots are poached with a really flavorful liquid. And, you know, apricots are always kind of that mysterious fruit where we often don't get them because they bloom really early and they get nipped by frost. But when we do have them, they're just so perfect. And it's such a short season. So this is a way that you can kind of take even a less than perfect apricot, poach it, add a little bit of that extra flavor in the ginger, and then the sweetness sort of balances the fattiness of that salmon. Plus, they're both that beautiful blush color. And so they look stunning together on the plate. And the ginger kind of pulls it all together, as does the chili oil that's spooned over the top. The chili oil just, you know, again, cuts through that richness of the salmon, counterbalances the sweetness in the apricots, and lends just a little bit of spice to it.
And mentioning those less than perfect looking apricots reminds me, another theme of your book is, well, this piece of fruit doesn't maybe look so great right now. I don't want to just take a bite out of it, but we can cut back on our waste by finding ways to incorporate it in our cooking.
Yeah, you know, fruit is always sort of frustrating for people, myself included, because sometimes it looks so perfect and so good, and then you taste it and the flavor is a little meh. And so that's when I feel like we have an opportunity as cooks to really kind of exert our own influence on it. And so most fruit, if you roast it or grill it or cook it down, you are concentrating the flavors by removing some of that extra moisture. Something like poaching it allows you to add some other flavors to it as well, and it gets sort of perfumed by the aromatics that are in that poaching liquid. There's also a ton of recipes for just raw preparations, and that's when you've got a perfect strawberry, you don't have to mess with it. Just the recipe in the book is a beet carpaccio. So it's roasted beets sliced really thinly, strawberries sliced over the top, a nice acidic vinaigrette, and then some candied fennel seeds and some herbs and edible flowers, and it's just stunning. So if the fruit is looking great, then just let it shine.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Abra Behrens about her new book. It's called Pulp, A Practical Guide to Cooking with Fruit. She focuses on fruit available here in the Midwest, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite dessert to make with a kind of local fruit, or do you use it in cooking and salads? Do you have questions about how to use blank? Rhubarb is on the way. We're going to talk about that. Do you have rhubarb favorites or questions? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday talk with Abra Behrens, chef, former farmer, and writer based in Michigan, talking about her new book, Pulp, A Practical Guide to Cooking with Fruit, focusing on fruits of the Midwest. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have questions or favorites to cook with anything on the fruit alphabet, apples, berries, cherries, the rest of them, call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Find some recipes from Abra at WPR.org/Food Friday. We had a question from Rebecca in Manitowoc who couldn't stay on the line. Rebecca called in to ask her a ground cherry recipe. Rebecca says she usually eats them straight up, but would like to try something new. Abra, you were just talking about those ground cherries. What kind of things do you like to do with them?
My favorite ground cherry recipe in the book is a whole head of cauliflower that's roasted with ground cherries in the pan with the cauliflower. And so they burst and they reduce their liquid, and you just spoon that liquid over the head of cauliflower. And then you finish it with a little bit of thyme, which is a garlic sauce that's really quick to make. And then it has a little bit of cashews on it and some parsley. So that's a really great full main course. I mean, that with a salad is a full dinner in my household, and it gets kind of sticky and sweet and a little bit tangy and a little bit garlicky. On the sweet side, I tend to cook ground cherries down a little if I'm not just going to eat them raw, which is like such a delicious way to have them. I usually saute them down a little bit and make kind of like a half jam, half chutney, and then spoon that over something like biscuits with some fresh butter. It goes really well with cheeses, things like that.
Hope that helps, Rebecca. Thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. Abra, rhubarb is just around the corner. I got a plant planted by a previous owner before I moved into a house. I always get a lot of rhubarb out of it. Do you point out, you know, in the biology lab, rhubarb's technically a vegetable, but in the kitchen, hey, it's a fruit. What are some of your favorite things to do with rhubarb?
The rhubarb, I've been poaching it a lot lately. I feel like poaching kind of fell out of favor, you know, in the 80s when everybody was poaching chicken breasts and nobody was happy about it. But it's a really wonderful technique, and it's something you can just simmer the big chunks of rhubarb in a really flavorful liquid, and then it's a little bit tangy and sweet and soft and supple, and it goes really well. I have a recipe in there for a cream puff that is then filled with the poached rhubarb. And the first half of the cookbook is what I call the baker's toolkit. And that is a collection of almost 100 recipes that I've collected over the years, either in my own work or when I've worked next to a great pastry chef and they've lent me the recipe. And then they all kind of can mix and match and pair with fruit in different ways. So I really love that rhubarb and cream puff combination.
And I make a lot of crisp because it's super easy and hard to mess up. But I do apple rhubarb crisp and things like that. I've done rhubarb bars, kind of like lemon bars. The curse is you got to be careful. Rhubarb's really tart. Like, how do you make sure? And I feel like I'm adding a lot of sugar here and it still ends up being pretty tart. How do we calibrate that?
Yeah, I mean, I love the combination of apple and rhubarb because I feel like it's always nice when the end of one season butts up right against the start of another. So the apples will lend some sweetness to it. The other way that I like to get some of that sweetness or at least mimic some of the sweetness is to, you can sear it and that will give you that kind of nice, deep caramelized flavor without having to add extra sugar. And it kind of helps take the liquid out. And so it concentrates it again. So I like doing that sometimes. I also eat rhubarb raw a lot. There's a dish, speaking of salmon, there's a raw rhubarb salad with poached fish in it. And I just love that combination. And then you can kind of just embrace the tartness, slice it super thinly, have it raw, and it'll kind of pucker up the salad for you.
Now, here's another recipe you shared with us. It's at WPR.org/Food Friday. Uses up a couple of ingredients that might still be left over from the fall, a celery root or celeriac, they call it, and tart apples. You call it a snowmelt stew. Pretty good creative name. Tell us, this is a combination I would not have anticipated. Tell us about that.
Yeah, celery root is another sort of underlauded vegetable. And I love it in, you know, December and January when you're getting into those storage root crops. And it has just the perfect amount of starch in it that when you blend it into a soup, it makes a very silky soup without having to add any flour or anything like that. And yet it has, I mean, it's celery, so it has that kind of tannicness that celery often has. And the apples just balance that out. So you sweat the onions and a little bit of garlic and the celery root and the apples together, add your liquid to it, bring it up and let it simmer until everything is really soft and then blitz it in the blender. And you're right about the name. That name is a fully made up, just kind of silly name, because when I would put on the restaurant menu apple celery root soup, it didn't sell. But snow melt stew, that people can't buy enough of that.
Talking to Abra Behrens, her latest book is called Pulp, A Practical Guide to Cooking with Fruit. She focuses on fruit from the Midwest. She's in Michigan. We have a lot of the same fruit here in Wisconsin. All right, let's get into something that kind of surprised me. Maybe it shouldn't. You'd share ideas for pickling our fruit.
Yeah, I love pickling things. You know, some things like apples and pears, I'll pickle with just a normal pickle liquid recipe because they oftentimes have a firm enough flesh that they can stand up to that liquid. The other thing I like to do is a very restauranty thing called make a gastrique, which is you make a dark caramel and I take it pretty dark so that it's, you know, smoking and not overly sweet because you kind of caramelized all of that sugar down, and then you add vinegar to it, and that's what deglazes and softens and dissolves the hard caramel. And then that liquid is like both very sweet and very tangy. And then I just pour that liquid over something like raspberries or blueberries or even cherries, anything like that. And it just really amplifies the inherent sweet and sourness of the fruit and makes it acidic enough that you can spoon it over super rich things. And it almost functions like a dressing on a salad. Or there's a recipe in the book that has a roasted carrot dish with pickled raspberries that I really love.
I guess it shouldn't surprise me that much because it's been a while, but I made an apple chutney, which is basically a particular form of a pickled fruit, right?
It is. And it's funny. My dad was just over. He attended a dinner here at Grainer Farm that we did based on the book. And he pointed out that there are not enough chutneys in the book. That's how he really likes fruit. So you can't win them all. But yes, chutney is very much of that same ilk.
Now, let's talk about, you know, in the summer, of course, we're going to eat lots of salads. You've already touched on a couple of the things that are very salad-like. I think one of your recipes has a quote-unquote salad in the name. Share some of your favorite ways to use those summertime fruits in salads.
You know, a lot of times in the summer for a salad, I'll just keep things really simple and use the fruit just raw. One of my favorite kind of late summer salads is a salad with grapes and fennel and butter lettuce. And then it's dressed really simply just with buttermilk. And I've used buttermilk in that way a lot because it has, you know, the perfect balance to me of a fattiness from the milk itself and then a tang from it being cultured. And you don't have to mess with adding olive oil and vinegar and mustard and all the things that are normally in a dressing. So it makes it super fast. It's really easy and very, very just surprising and delicious. There's also a blueberry salad that's dressed with buttermilk that has some oat groats in it for a little bit of texture, and then lots of different types of greens. So it really depends on which one you're kind of after, but you can load up all sorts of different fruits into any kind of salad.
I want to turn the clock forward a little bit to apple season. You know, at grocery stores, you might have a couple few choices. If you hit the orchards or the farmer's market, you might have a lot more. How do we figure out the right tool for the right job, the right apple for a particular dish we're making?
It's a hard one, and that's where I think having the opportunity to talk to a grower, talk to the people at the grocery store really helps because they can direct you in one direction or another. Most of the time, I'm looking for a very tart apple. If Especially if I'm going to be baking with it or doing any sort of preparation. If I'm eating it out of hand, I might buy a sweeter apple. But generally, I just ask what's the tartest and what's going to hold together. You know, I did a lot of my culinary training in Ireland and the UK, and they separate between baking apples and floury apples. And a floury apple will just immediately fall apart as soon as it's cooked, but it has, you know, it's perfect for like an applesauce or something like that. But a baking apple will hold its shape. And so if you ask a grower, they're going to know which how they use it, because most of the time fruit growers are using that fruit in their own kitchens as well.
And just a half minute left. We're at the end. So let's ask about dessert, your favorite fruit dessert.
I think my favorite, it's a hard one, but my favorite, because of its versatility, is the rum plum clafoutis tea. Clafoutis tea is a French dessert, but it sounds fancier than it is. It's a you just whisk together some eggs, some milk, a little bit of flour, a little bit of sugar, and then pour it over whatever type of fruit. And I really like it with plums because plums often, again, are tart enough to stand up to it. But traditionally, it's made with cherries. I've made it with cranberries. I've made it with rhubarb. I've even made it with blueberries. There's lots of different fruit that can balance it. And it's the thing that always comes together when you know how sometimes you get house guests that don't tell you that they're coming when they're coming. And so it's something I can usually pull together with what's in my fridge or freezer.
Abra, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for the time and for creating space for us to talk about food every Friday.
That's Abra Behrens. Her latest book is called Pulp, A Practical Guide to Cooking with Fruit. She focuses on fruit available here in the Midwest. You can check out the Food Friday recipes Abra shared with us. They're online at wpr.org/foodfriday. And you can share your favorite things to cook or bake with fruit. Send us a note, email ideas@wpr.org. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, it's the State Capitol Report. This week, a look at issues including school safety funding, election laws, and more. That's Monday morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, it's the Friday World News Roundup with a ceasefire in Sudan and an arrest of alleged Chinese secret police in Manhattan. Those stories and more tonight at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, Dominion Voting Systems settled its defamation lawsuit against Fox News earlier this week, with Fox agreeing to pay $787 million in damage to the voting machine company. The settlement was struck just minutes before a trial was set to begin. Dominion sued Fox over false claims that hosts on the network made about voting machine fraud during the 2020 election. Court filings during the case showed that Fox executives and hosts doubted some of the claims they were making on air. The network acknowledged false claims in a statement but won't have to apologize on air. Here's a listen to Dominion attorney Justin Nelson after the settlement.
This litigation cannot solve all problems. All of us remain ever vigilant to find common factual ground. Today represents a ringing endorsement for truth and for democracy.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to this settlement between Fox News and Dominion? Are you disappointed it didn't make it to the trial? What would you have wanted to learn more about? What questions do you have about the media laws involved and what can happen when a news outlet makes false claims? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Ronell Anderson-Jones is a professor at the University of Utah's S.J. Quinney College of Law. She specializes in the relationship between media and the courts. press access and defamation cases. She's also a former newspaper reporter and editor. Ronell, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Is this case comparable to much else we've seen in the courts when it comes to media defamation lawsuits?
No, this case is something of a unicorn. The constitutional bar in these kinds of cases involving public figures and matters of public concern is set incredibly high. So these are very difficult cases to bring. And because of that, they don't get brought very often. And when they are brought, they virtually always settle at a much earlier stage than this. So this is the rare case that proceeded all the way to the very cusp of trial. And it's rare in that the public got to see in filings in the court this fairly rich trove of evidence that Dominion said that it could use to show that high constitutional standard of knowing falsity or reckless disregard for the truth.
I want to talk about that bar, that standard, a little more. It's not just a media outlet made a mistake, or even that the mistake they made was disparaging in some way about the person suing. What more needs to be established to even get a case like this into a courtroom in the first place?
That's right. The United States Supreme Court has said that because we want to have a broad scope of freedom for press speakers and those who are commenting on matters of public concern, it isn't enough in these kinds of cases to show that the media outlet was sloppy or that it was negligent or that it was biased or even that it was inaccurate. You have to show what the court called actual malice. It's sort of a poor term for the actual concept. It doesn't mean malice in the sense of anger or bad feelings, but rather is about the news outlet's relationship with the truth. It's about what they knew. It's a state of mind standard. But you have to climb inside those shoes and demonstrate to the jury by clear and convincing evidence that the media entity knew or recklessly disregarded the falsity that it ultimately broadcasted. And it's quite difficult, and deliberately so. The court said, we don't want it to be easy for people to weaponize defamation law against those who are commenting on matters of public concern. And so we set the standard very high and make it possible for there to be quite a lot of falsehood that still circulates in the press and gets countered in other ways, only in these rare instances of a sort of knowing, conscious lie that harms reputation can recovery happen.
Before we dig into Fox, one more point of contrast here. Sarah Palin, former Alaska governor, former vice presidential candidate, had filed a libel suit against the New York Times. A column had gotten something wrong about her. It did not paint her in a flattering light. It did not make it to anywhere near this stage of court. What was going on there that made that fall short of that bar?
Yeah, that case happened last year. It was between Palin and the New York Times, and it was different, I guess, in two important ways. One important way was that it involved a single statement, one sentence that was erroneous and harmful to Palin's reputation in a single publication in the New York Times. The Dominion suit was more about a pattern and practice. There were 20 total suits, 19 of which Dominion said were broadcasted on Fox after Dominion had alerted Fox to the falsity of these wild allegations and had pointed Fox and its hosts in the direction of accurate information. So in terms of scope and scale, this was a much different kind of suit. And then the second way that it was different was in terms of the proof of evidence of knowing falsity. In the Sarah Palin suit, Palin's camp attempted to demonstrate that the New York Times ought to have had a high degree of awareness of the probable falsity of the statement that was made there, connecting Palin's campaign erroneously to a shooting that had occurred. But it was a much more distant and tangential evidence in comparison to the Dominion suit, where Dominion had gathered through discovery a large body of internal evidence of actual text messages and memos within Fox saying things like, this is a lie, this is ludicrous, this is crazy, pointing to what Dominion said was proof not just of a high degree of awareness of the probable falsity, but actual knowledge of falsity on the part of Fox and its hosts.
Talking to Ronell Anderson-Jones from University of Utah's College of Law, looking at the Fox News settlement with the voting company, voting machine company, Dominion. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, your reactions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Nate is with us in Milwaukee. Nate, hi.
Hi, thank you for having me. Believe it or not, I was one of those people who was kind of hoping to see this thing go to trial. And that's in part because I was hoping more details would come out. I also think that while Fox is paying out money to a company that it caused harm to, there's a value that we might miss to a degree of basically at the end of the court case, Fox News potentially being required to say to its viewers, hey, we lied to you about this big thing. And with them not being able to require it, they might hope to sweep this under the rug in a year or two. And I'm curious just how dishonest Fox News or other organizations might be, because this is one of those few times where we as outsiders actually get to see some of the internal thoughts in that organization.
Nate, thanks a lot for that call. Ronell, Nate brings up a couple of big points there. First, he's disappointed. He was hoping we would learn more with a lot of key Fox personalities on the stands, I think, in a trial. What do we not get because of this settlement?
Yes, well, your caller is expressing a frustration that I think was commonplace, and it actually points to a wider point that this case has helped us see as sort of as a nation and as a people. Defamation law might be one tool that we think of as useful in the wider fight against broader societal disinformation, but it's in many respects a limited tool. Here, Dominion was only able to sue about the lies that were told about Dominion, very specific defamatory lies that harmed the reputation of this particular company. And it all happens in this framework that is motivated by civil litigation between these two corporations, which means that eventually when the settlement number gets high enough here, upwards of $750 million, the folks who hold financial interests in those companies really have very little choice but to move forward and make decisions that are better than rolling the dice and moving before a jury, no matter how confident you might feel in your claim. And so the desire that a lot of folks have to play out and litigate in the public sphere wider questions of election denialism and disinformation more broadly are sometimes disappointed, right, in the limitations that defamation law has. The caller is also definitely correct that we would have gotten more detail had we moved forward to trial. Scheduled on the witness list were a number of key players at Fox, including some of the biggest named hosts and Rupert Murdoch, who sits atop the Fox Corporation structure. And so a lot of this story would have been played out of the mouths of key Fox players themselves. That said, Dominion did delay this settlement until truly the 11th hour. I mean, the 11th hour and the 59th minute. Mm-hmm. The jury was impaneled. Oral arguments were about to begin. And because this didn't settle earlier, I mean, if this had settled, for example, in February, before the trove of evidence that was gathered in the case had been made public, these kinds of conversations that we're having amongst the citizenry wouldn't have been able to take place. And you can imagine Fox would have been quite incentivized to have settled prior to the revelation of all of this evidence about what people internally there said about Donald Trump, what people there said about their own sources, what they said about their own audience. And Dominion presumably refused to settle at that stage, moving to a place in which more of that information made its way into the public sphere and could spur the kinds of conversations that we're having now.
And Nate also brings up the point that Dominion had been hoping for an apology, an admission of guilt, maybe even an on-air to their own viewers admission of being wrong here. That doesn't appear to be part of this settlement. What do you make of that, Ronell?
Yes, I can only expect that Dominion sought for that component of the settlement and that Fox drew a hard line in the sand in refusing to do it. Fox didn't acknowledge knowing falsity. In fact, Fox didn't even acknowledge falsity. Fox acknowledged that the court acknowledged falsity. That's what that's the extent of the statement, that Fox recognized that the judge had held in pretrial motions, in response to pretrial motions, that these statements, some of these statements about Dominion were not accurate. And the fact that that's the most that Dominion could get out of Fox, and the desire that Fox has to continue to hold on to maybe some of that audience base that might be craving the ongoing delivery of some of this election denialism, is itself maybe problematic. The core centerpiece of Dominion's whole suit is that Fox finds itself between a rock and a hard place on these questions of feeling a lot of pressure from Trump supporting viewers who threaten to gravitate to other news outlets in the right wing ecosystem that will deliver up more of this conspiratorial coverage of election denialism. And maybe some of those same pressures continue to exist to this day, which tells us an awful lot about both the problems that we have with the supply of disinformation, but also maybe the seemingly bottomless demand for it.
We're talking to Ronell Anderson-Jones, professor of law at the University of Utah, expert on media and the courts. We're looking at this week's $787 million settlement in a defamation case in which Dominion Voting Systems challenged Fox News. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about this case ending up in this settlement? What would you have wanted to see from a courtroom trial? What question do you have about how all of this works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Ronell Anderson-Jones, media law expert and law professor at the University of Utah, breaking down this week's settlement between Fox News and Dominion Voting Systems, a case stemming from Fox's false claims about Dominion's voting machines after the 2020 election. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this case ending in a settlement? Do you think that's enough accountability for Fox? Join in at 800-642-1234. Ronell, this was a big lawsuit. It's not the only lawsuit. Another voting machine company, Smartmatic, also suing Fox. Dominion also suing some of those other news outlets you mentioned. I believe Newsmax and the OAN One America News. What are you watching for in some of the other legal challenges still out there?
Yes, Dominion was sort of first in line here, the first to get out into the court system and get and move to a jury stage and then to a settlement stage. But there are definitely a number of other suits in the queue. The Smartmatic suit is the one that most of us are watching most closely, both because it is the largest. Smartmatic is another voting machine company. It's seeking $2.7 billion, so even more than was sought in the Dominion case. We're also watching it closely because it deeply parallels the Dominion suit in a lot of really important ways. Smartmatic's claim rises and falls on a lot of the same cast of characters, the same sets of key people, key hosts at Fox, Maria Bartiromo, Lou Dobbs, Jeanine Perrot. All of those programs were involved in the Dominion suit and are also involved in the Smartmatic one. And the sources are also overlapping. So people like Sidney Powell and Rudy Giuliani, who were espousing these false statements about Dominion, are also at the center of the Smartmatic case. The case is a little bit different, in part because of the role that Dominion and Smartmatic played in the 2020 election. Dominion is a much larger voting machine company in terms of its role in that particular election. It was involved in more polling places across the country. Fox was sort of arguing that it was it was important and newsworthy that it have conversations about Dominion because of its role in gathering ballots at that time. Smartmatic has, in many respects, a much stronger sort of David and Goliath kind of argument to make here. Smartmatic was falsely accused, it says, of being involved in rigging the 2020 election, but it in fact was had a very limited and quite uncontroversial role in the election at all. It was only used in one county in the whole country in that election, and so suggests that it was just sort of wholly invented as a villain to advance this conspiracy theory, and that might explain part of the reason why the damages that are sought are so much larger. So a lot of us will be watching really closely to see how the Smartmatic legal team builds upon what's already been revealed in the Dominion one, takes advantage of some of that body of evidence to try to make its case.
Let's go back to our callers. Tom is with us in Waupaca. Tom, hi.
Good afternoon. I'm a criminal defense attorney. If I were defending Fox, I would say, well, one of the elements is malice, and it wasn't really motivated by malice. It was motivated by profit motive and greed. I mean, Fox News didn't really have anything against Dominion. It's just they wanted to tell their viewers what they wanted to hear to preserve their viewership. And so, yeah, they knowingly lied, but it wasn't out of malice. It was just out of we're trying to keep our audience happy and continue to make profits.
Tom, I gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call. Rennell, you said in this context, malice isn't just sort of mustache twirling deviousness. Would profit fit that category here?
Yeah, it's a very poor choice of words on the part of the Supreme Court. I've sort of long said this and faced this frustration as a law professor trying to teach the concept to my students who are accustomed to thinking about malice in the criminal context that your caller just referenced. We just use it in a really different way here in the First Amendment space. It doesn't go to the feelings that the speaker had about the subject of the lie. It just goes to their attitude towards the truth. If they engaged in the lie knowingly, or if they showed reckless disregard for the truth or falsity of the statement, that counts as actual malice. And whether they were motivated by profit share or to win back audiences or by hatred or by any other motivation isn't particularly pertinent in the First Amendment context. We label it actual malice, but what we care about really is the question of the knowledge of falsity.
Time for one more quick call. Pat is with us in Milwaukee. Pat, hi.
Oh, hey, thanks for taking my call. A month ago, I said they're probably going to settle because overall, whether Murdoch's wise enough or proud, too proud to not want to say what he thought, his attorneys finally convinced them to settle because it would be a year long of advertising about how poorly they're run. But I was surprised that I would think the prosecuting side would say, hey, you want to miss a year of bad PR. Not only are you going to not pay the price we're asking, but you're going to pay a premium. So it's kind of, I'm not a lawyer, so I know the workings are more serious numbers, but I thought they'd actually pay more than the settlement.
And gotcha, Pat. We're just about out of time. Rennell, your thoughts on they kind of split the difference in the overall settlement amount in just our last minute or so.
Yes, I think that's right. It is exceedingly rare for a settlement to be for the asking price at the beginning stage, the amount of damages that were sought at the trial, and would be almost unheard of for the settlement number to be higher than that amount. This number is pretty high, and we think, although these settlements are not often made public, we think it may well be the highest number at which a defamation suit is settled in the history of defamation suits in America. But I agree that lots of folks expected that maybe Dominion held had a lot of cards in its hand at the final moment. It does seem clear that Fox would have been motivated to come to the table in order to avoid a longer, more drawn out, attention grabbing trial that was to come. Juries are just unpredictable. So both parties probably had a pretty significant incentive by the end not to roll the dice and go before one.
Right now, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
That's Ronell Anderson-Jones, professor at the University of Utah's S.J. Quinney College of Law, also a former newspaper reporter and editor, with us for a look at the settlement in the Fox News Dominion Voting Systems lawsuit. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, the U.S. saw a string of shootings last week where people fired at people who mistakenly entered their property without presenting an obvious threat. UW law professor looks at those cases. That's coming up Monday here on Central Time.